Well, I think the security leaders have learned over the years that our job, and this is going to sound a bit ironic per this conversation, is education. Our job is to teach the board, our peer executives, the CEO. Our job is to teach what good is, where we're at, and how we're getting better.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve speaks with Amanda Fennell, a security professional with over two decades in the industry who currently serves as CISO and CIO of Prove. She's also an adjunct professor of cybersecurity at Tulane University. Amanda speaks with Steve about why a CISO must be an educator at heart, how to embrace feedback in order to grow, and how young professionals can shape their careers in security as the role of the CISO evolves.
So Amanda, it's lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm enjoying it. I get to have my coffee with you. I'm excited.
Now, you've been in the security industry for a little while, over 20 years. And over that period of time, you've obviously worked as a consultant, you've worked with end user organizations, and today you're a CISO with Prove. You also, though, teach cybersecurity, which I thought was very interesting, with a particular focus on incident response, digital forensics, and threat intelligence. You've been doing that for over 10 years now. And I wanted to start there. I wanted to really get your take on how that has evolved over the last 10 years, because certainly from our members' standpoint, you know, it's one of the things that they talk to me a lot about, particularly being overwhelmed by the sheer volume of threats and data and how do you manage it? So, you know, what's your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think the evolution of what we teach is a big part of this. So when I first started, I had decided to go into digital forensics, mostly because I couldn't find a really good job as an archaeologist. And I was like, how can I go somewhere where I can dig and still get paid to pay off my student loans? So when I originally started, I got recruited really quickly from the forensic software company for NCASE guidance software, and then all the government. And they didn't care what I had learned. They just cared that on my resume, it said I was getting formal education. It was a new novelty at that point for there to be a formally educated cybersecurity person. And the government loved it in the US, that is. So it started where, you know, I went through this education at the time for myself, and it was, you know, networking, very specific. A lot of the tools that we teach now are the same tools that I learned 17 years ago, Cain and Abel and Jack the Ripper, things like John the Ripper. But what's changed over the years is what we're trying to hit home in the education. So the important skills that come up is not so much, can you tell me what port this is? Can you go through the different OSI levels, which I used to get in interviews when they would pick at me, you know, which level is this? Now, that's great that you can Google that. So I don't need to know that you know how to Google. I need to know you know how to work with other people. And right. So we tend to do a lot more hands-on and man alive. Do they hate all the team things that you have to do in these classes? But I need to see that you are able to be an expert in something and you're able to use that information with other people for the whole story. So this is where I think things have changed about technical knowledge and the skill sets that we want to give them. That's great. That's part of the pie. How much fun are you to work with at 3 o'clock in the morning on a war room call is way better.
Mm. And how are you teaching that? Because there are some people listening to this, no doubt, who will come from the school of thought that says, you know, emotional intelligence, which is something that's required in that particular space to be effective, is not something that can be taught. You know, either you've got it or you haven't. And there are different views on that. So I'm interested in that. You can certainly fake it.
Yeah. And you know what? Honestly, this is a really great point about pulling in, like, what if you have it? What if you don't? The first thing we do with everything in a scientific background and forensics is identification, right? I need to know, do I have it? Do I not have it? So one of the first things we do is personality testing. We do that at my work. We do that at my school. We do that all the time because I need to know. For example, I'm an INTJ, not going to go well if you want to be an extrovert and talk to me for 3 hours. This is a great session. I'm going to do great in this. I'm not going to do great after 3 hours. So knowing what your weakness is and then working around that. So setting yourself up for success. So you do need to know, you can't teach it, but you can certainly educate. This is going to be important. So how do we do this? Like for myself, I often bring in subject matter experts that are hands-on keyboard for different parts of the curriculum. So one of them is monitoring. So I bring in somebody from my current team who spends all of their time in event monitoring and SIM, Splunk, things like that, screen shares it, walks through it, but it isn't just about the content, the technical information she's imparting. It's actually about how she's interacting with you. She never puts a camera on. She's really introverted and she needs the space to not feel like that psychological thing about cameras. But she's still very effective. So she's learned how to get her content across with a little bit of humor that's very subtle. But those kind of things are what we're trying to teach with bringing in people who are doing the job and showing them how they're doing it in more than just the technical know-how. It's about the EQ as well.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And that is one of the things that I think security leaders in particular are potentially struggling with still at the moment, not just in the way that they communicate with their teams, but also the way they communicate back then into the business. So have you got any tips or insights that you can share with us on those aspects? The security leader who knows they ought to be doing something different, but doesn't quite know how to crack it.
Well, I think the security leaders have learned over the years that our job, and this is going to sound a bit ironic per this conversation, is education. Our job is to teach the board, our peer executives, the CEO, our job is to teach what good is, where we're at, and how we're getting better. And also there are other aspects, like they want to know how we compete or how we're measuring up with other people in the industry and so forth. Over the years, education and security merging together so much has gotten so good that at this point you could leverage several frameworks to do this. A lot of people would use like a CMMI maturity framework or a cybersecurity framework, et cetera. But our job is really to gather that information to say, where are we at risk? What is good? How do we get better? And show that quarterly update that things are changing and we're getting better if they need to be. So it's measurable progress. But it almost makes it sound so businessy and boring, and it's not. It's great to watch things like you have a scoring that you would have for threat intelligence. How good are we? How good do we need to be? That's always a good question based on your industry. Do we really need to be good, or can we handle this with just getting certain feeds into our SIM or something? And how big of a risk is that with the threat landscape? These questions are like that. That's what we spend our time doing with the business, is to say, we're educating you. This is a risk. This is not a risk, and so forth. So education.
Yeah. And I guess as well, not being afraid to be challenged, right? Because you don't have the absolute answer. And indeed, some of the posture, the risk posture that then evolves is based upon that challenge, that discussion with the business, giving its view, you providing some of the intel and insight there.
You just made me remember like one of these watershed moments in my career when I didn't take feedback well. And it was like 15 years ago. It was a long, long time ago. My boss sat me down for a performance review and said, you know, you have a reputation for not taking feedback well because you're really sure that you're right. And I took that to heart. And for a long time, I did have to fake that feedback coming to me like, thank you for the feedback. I'll think about this. That's so, you know, whatever. And just freeze your face into a smile. Now, I love it. I invite it. You learn over time that the input is what actually makes you stronger and will make you better. And it's either they're wrong and you can explain this information to them and give them all the data that you have and they'll understand it and say, oh, okay, I understand why you did that. Or they're going to give you a perspective you didn't know, which I think is the point of diversity. I'm going to give you all the data. You have a different perspective and or experience, and we're going to get stronger because of it. So totally agree with you that this is a big area that you have to be able to take the feedback to be stronger. It does boil down to, I often say, confidence and competence. You have to be confident about what you're doing, but you have to be competent as well in making sure that you're delivering and doing the right things. And you won't be able to do that if you don't take the input.
No, that's absolutely right. I think one of the things that I still observe is that all too often, security leaders fall back on being defensive. Yeah. As opposed to embracing that sort of opportunity to actually go head to head with somebody in a business leadership position. Not so that you prove whether or not somebody is right or wrong. It's not about that. But it is about this trying to get to the real bottom of what's going to positively impact? And this is where I'm a fan of this sort of outcome-driven security. You know, what is it that we do that's really going to move the business forward?
I think that's why it was the smartest thing I did was to start being an educator. You learn when you have 30, 50 people that are in a room that you don't know. There's always going to be somebody who thinks that they're smarter than you as the teacher, and they're going to show it, and they're going to be abrasive and difficult to deal with. There's always going to be people who have zero knowledge about the topic, and you have to bring them up to the same level as everybody else for an even playing field. I believe that that's what every room is in business. You are an educator of your information. There's always going to be a question I don't know the answer to. So how you handle that with aplomb is going to be everything. I didn't do it great 15 years ago, but you're right. But this exchange is just one of the most important things you're going to have to do is I'm here to educate. I'm here to be a subject matter expert on my area. You know, if I have a board member from Walmart, there's a high probability that they've seen something that I may not have seen. I want to hear that with my ears open and listen to the dialogue as opposed to closed off. So that's, I guess, the worst thing I say in this conversation is the fake it until you make it. But the reality is you do have to be approachable. So if someone does come up to me and or in a meeting or tries to challenge something about a risk or a mitigation that needs to be done, my response immediately has to be stop, open eyes wider. It's a physical psychological response, eyes wider, eyebrows up, bit of a smile. Listen, lean in physically a bit, and it all shows and transmits that information of like, I'm seeking to understand. Give me more information. That sounds great.
So, I mean, that's some really good advice for people who've got these meetings with business leaders or are called, you know, to present to a board on a quarterly or half yearly basis, whatever it might be. What other tips have you got for people who perhaps are a little bit not too sure about how to approach that because maybe they're new in role? So it could be a first-time CISO, never had to do it before, or maybe some of the leadership has changed, strategy has changed. What are some of the things that they should be doing before they throw themselves into this potential opportunity?
Into this fray. Yeah. Well, I think one of the most important things that I've always leaned back on, and we love this in security, is that there are foundational things that are never changing. There are some things that are just, that is the way the cake is baked. And so some of those and being able to rely upon those foundational core principles in security, as well as your approach being consistent. So this is probably a horrible example, but I know where I put my keys every time in my life, right? I know how Amanda works. I know where Amanda puts her keys because I follow the same exact process all the time. And so if I lose my keys, I just think back, well, where would I have put them? Got it. They're right there. And so that is where you get a lot of your confidence over time is that you know how you did it. You used the scientific approach. You went through the different methodology that's the same every time. Certainly iterate over time to become better if you find different ways. But I think foundational core principles in security that we all know, you know, role of least privileges, making sure you're mitigating risk, understanding that risk is probability times impact. I have to say that probably at least 10 times in a quarter to either board members or peers or so forth is that risk is equal to probability times impact. So when you're coming at me with this vulnerability you found out about on the news, which is what we get a lot in security, right? People come at us and throw something at us and it's FUD, it's fear, uncertainty, and doubt. We're at risk for this. Breathe. Start from the beginning. Great. It sounds like this is a core security issue you're concerned about. This is how we handle vulnerability management. We do A, we do B, we process it. We have these SLAs. Just go through your process and get confident about your process because that's how we, and then be open to iterating and making it better. If somebody says, great, that all sounds great, but you should have had an SLA here that was better. Got it. Appreciate the feedback. Smile. So, but the security fundamentals will help you and they always do. And I think that's, again, goes back to, it's our job to educate. Not everybody knows it and they certainly aren't going to remember it. We have to say it 70 times. So just make sure you educate and come from a place of your job is to light the light in other people. I'm not here to tell you do things because I said it. I'm here so that you can understand why we're doing this and why we're trying to protect the business.
Well, one of the things that certainly we spend quite a bit of time doing at the ISF is looking into the way in which the CISO career might evolve. What are the sort of direction? What are the opportunities? And, you know, sometimes it's called life after security leadership. But, you know, if security leaders are becoming more hybrid in nature, I mean, I noticed that you yourself, for instance, have an interesting job title, approve of CISO and CIO. But if they're becoming more hybrid, Does that, do you think, unlock career progression beyond just the world of the CISO and vice versa? What's your take on that?
You're stumbling upon one of the more controversial topics in this industry right now, and you know it. So this title situation, one of the things is there, and it's what I struggle with. So if I go to look for a position and I go and, you know, list that I'm a CISO, because fundamentally that's what I feel. And I'll mention career progression in a second, but mm-hmm. I want to mention, so I feel as if my, you know, DNA is a security officer. It's what my love of life is. But the people over time have learned, wow, we could probably save a little bit of money, because the same people who are trying to do things with our infrastructure and run our infrastructure as business are the same ones who are securing it. Let's slam it together. CIOs and CISOs together in arms. And for a bit there, everyone thought that that was very two-faced. How could you possibly do that? Like, you're in Batman, like you've got, you know, two different sides to you, and there's no way you can reconcile that. No. When security is your backbone, you can do anything. You just have to measure the priorities for the different functions. So that's one issue, that the title's starting to mean something different for a lot of people. For example, I don't only have security and IT. I also have global support for the product, which is kind of a customer officer role. Mm-hmm. I also have platform engineering, and currently I also have engineering, which is a CTO role. Mm-hmm. What people have learned is that security officers are becoming more and more trained as executives and can roll up their sleeves and go into different roles. They can do most of it, and they're going to do it with the security backbone. So that's awesome. So I have a platform engineering team that's rocking it and doing some of the best things in security for identity access management, because they know that's one of my core values is secure by default, evergreen identity access, constantly auditing, things like that. So I think businesses have learned that the title, it's less about the specifics and it's more about training us as executives, and CISOs are getting more and more training. I mean, I can run numbers and revenue like nobody's business these days. 15 years ago, absolutely not. I was like, I'm here to represent security and how we're going to secure from this vulnerability or something. But now it's, and I learned that my last job, my boss told me, when you sit at the exec table, you take off your hat as a security officer and you sit there as an exec for this company. You keep your ears open for something that does sound security relevant that we should know about, but your job is to make sure that we're all going to be successful. So I learned that a lot and appreciate it. And that's why I think it's really difficult for us these days as CISOs. We don't know what to put on our resume anymore. We're an executive, and that sounds so ambiguous.
Well, I think it's the direction that we have to move in. I mean, you know, I often say to people that I'm not aware of any business today that isn't dependent upon technology and data. And if you're dependent upon technology and data, you've got a security issue. But it isn't a security issue in isolation. It's integral to everything that you do. And so therefore, your CISO should be an executive. He or she should be able to understand all of the business issues and talk in business language about the way in which security can be used to unlock some of the more thorny problems and challenges and all of that good stuff. So it's good to hear that you've moved in that direction, and that's the way you see the industry moving.
I do. And I think probably my other big advice for people who are first-time CISOs or new in their role, become good friends with your legal officer. That's going to be your best friend on the team. They understand, especially if they have compliance and audit. Those people, and I say this as someone who worked at a legal tech company software for 5 years, but your legal officers understand security and risk really well, and they're going to help you to interpret and translate things often. And that has been one of my biggest helps in my career.
Yeah, and the way that regulation is going, particularly if you happen to work for a multinational, it changes pretty regularly, and keep up with it.
Exactly why I was thinking that when you said that, because you brought up data. And so data governance, data movement, data flow, all of these things, GDPR, et cetera, any of them are SREMs too, constantly evolving. If you yourself are not a lawyer, don't pretend to be. Get one involved, because you want to make sure that you're up to date with all of these regulations about where the data is, because it's absolutely where we're at. Everything's moving, everything's constantly flowing, and it is all over the world.
Now, one of the things I particularly like about the security space is that it is so very fast moving, and you never really know the way in which it's going to evolve. There are lots of things coming in, like, you know, AI, like quantum, all of that kind of stuff that is impacting the way in which we conduct security across the different enterprises around the world. But that also is increasing, for some people, the level of stress and strain of being in a security leadership position. So what advice do you have for people listening as to how to cope with some of those stresses and strains?
Oh, man. I mean, first of all, was not prepped for this, but what a good question. I love this. You know, over the years, you know, the executive team is essentially where a CEO, a founder, et cetera, has decided to split up everything like a pizza pie. And like, there's just segments of stress. So it's lifting and shifting the stress of anything security, and in this case, infrastructure and so forth, is now on my shoulders. The first day that I took over, I was at Zurich Insurance Financial, based out of Switzerland. But the first day that I took on a global incident response role as a VP, I remember I woke up and my arms were covered in hives. Like, I was stressed. I recognized the importance and the responsibility of what had just been put on my shoulders. And that from that day forward, I'm responsible for somehow 150,000 people not getting breached. So the pressure and stress was a physical manifestation. So over the years, I don't know how, and you've been around with so many of these different people in this industry. I don't know how other people handled it. I didn't do great. I gained weight originally over the years because I had to travel a lot and speaking and things like that. So I lost sight of that. It was not great, but you over time get more confident about, okay, nothing bad's happened. And when bad things do happen, I handled it. I got in front of it and I have the tough skin to get through this. I've got the memory and the muscle to get through this now. Nowadays, I prioritize my own mental health and stress relief over everything. And so that's the first thing. And I don't mean to be super granola, but it is very cliche to say this, but it's true. The whole your teacup first has to be filled before you can give it to other people. So recognizing that that is what people are looking for from you in any leadership position. They're not looking at you to come in and be able to do all the things. This is my favorite quote. It's Horatio Hornblower. It's never run on deck. It makes everyone else nervous. I can be nervous in my head. I could be screaming that, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. We have a state-sponsored attack or something like this that's going on. Externally, you do learn to control your energy and recognize that it's going to set the tone for the rest of the room and the rest of the group, the people on it. So my advice, focus on yourself. I absolutely do use things like our company does a sponsorship for things like the Calm app and things like that.
Right.
Absolutely. Little 60-second breaks. I also spend a significant amount of time reading a lot of, not self-help books, but leadership books, how to always be better in a growth mindset. I'm reading one right now about how to be a unicorn leader, right? How can you do all the things? And it always seems to hit home that we have to figure out how to be something that people want to be. And that has to be healthy and calm and able to get things accomplished and do good and create value. That's why we're in the positions that we're in. So I think over the years, I just learned to prioritize health, fitness, eating better, you know, junk in, junk out, as we say in the SIM, you know, security business. You don't want junky logs. You're not going to get great information from it. It's the same thing with you as an executive. It needs to be something that's going to be helpful to you so you can be calm.
And I think that, you know, one of the things just listening to you there, it took me back to the pandemic era because everybody was really big on those things then. You know, you have to spend time away from the screen. You have to spend time for yourself. You know, we all adopted meditation apps and that kind of thing and indeed encouraged our staff to do that. And then it seems to me that post-pandemic, perhaps we lost some of that because we thought, okay, you know, we're back at it now. And so I think it is worth just reminding people that you can only give of your best if you've taken care of yourself, if you've taken the time, as you've just outlined there. And I think, it, you know, from a security leadership standpoint, it's incumbent upon leaders everywhere, actually, not just in security, to make sure that their staff are doing that and creating time if they're not doing it themselves.
Well, so you've come upon a really great point that I also believe we've made a mistake, that we overcorrected after started things opening up after COVID. We overcorrected and we started leaving a lot of that stuff and we shouldn't have. Because nothing changes the fact that we are managers and leaders of human beings. Well, for right now, and until we have some AI on the team. But so that is the job. And I was going to mention this when we talked about this earlier, but the reality is I spend a significant amount of my time in the people area. The processes are already built. The strategy is already set. I mean, we're in, you know, so late in the year. My strategy is set. It's being executed on. OKRs are being done. Program reviews are happening. All that stuff is on autopilot. I spend a significant amount of my time on people development. I have to make sure that everybody is performing, that they have training, that they have exposure. We have sessions on burnout, how to identify. Most of my time is how can I empower this team of people to do great things? Once all that stuff is set in security strategy and so forth, it runs. It's a train. It keeps going. The people who are on the train are where I have to spend all my time. So people who are going into this role, you're going to spend some time in security strategy for sure. And you're going to spend a lot of time on budget. That's the love. But you'll spend the most time on your people if you're a good leader. I hope I'm a good leader, but we'll see.
And indeed you should, because, you know, I always say that when the chips are down, when you do have a breach or something is going not in the ideal way, technology rarely is going to dig you out of that hole. It's going to be the people who are going to work the shifts, who are going to actually fix it. And so you need to take care of them beforehand so that they can give of their best when they're actually needed.
It sounds so unbelievably, like you would hope that everyone would know that. But people do not show up to cover things when an incident happens because it's their job. They show up because they care. Yeah. And there have been many a time whenever something's happened, like I'm in a flight, I'm traveling, I can't do something, that I have a flight of people or, you know, all these people who swarm in to take care of it for me. And I hesitate to use the word love, but there is certainly a lot of appreciation that you have to put in the bank with those people in that relationship so that they will do that for you. They will go the extra mile and above and beyond. But then that they're also high performers. I spend a lot of time trying to identify high performance and nurturing that.
I think that's, you know, one of the, certainly what I find to be one of the most interesting parts of the job as any executive is really trying to bring out the best in the people that you've gotten to give them opportunity. You know, it's about making sure that they can have fun, that they have opportunity, and that they continue to grow.
My biggest indicator of that that I've learned in recent years for me is how do people handle change? And if they, I mean, I'm in a startup right now, so there's a lot of change. But how someone handled change, if they thrive with it, they're normally a high performer. You're looking at a high up on a nine box, like that's going to be a high performer. They're ready for it. If they manage it, they're steady. They're just the steady person who's going to manage through something. They're going to do the work. But if they struggle with change, they are going to struggle with a lot of things in security. There are a lot of things that are very, that seem horrible in the beginning of the morning when the day starts, you know, when there's a new release of a CVE exploit that's going all over the place and it hits the fan and you've got your board member inundating you with, I saw this on the news, what's going on? How are we protect? You have to scurry and run around and go and get all that information and calm everybody down. And if you don't thrive in that pressure and stress or manage it, you will struggle in security.
Amanda, it's been lovely talking to you. We sort of covered a whole range of different things there, but I think actually spent the right amount of time talking about what's important, which is the people aspect and how we can actually get the best from our people. So thank you very much for sharing those insights. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. I know, not where I expected us to go, but once we did, you had no idea of knowing my favorite topic. I'm like, I love talking about the people side. So it was really awesome. Thank you.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Amanda Fennell. If you found value in the conversation today, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.